we found as deformations of or living in the moduli space of some CFT. Of course, they're also dual to theories of quantum gravity and ADS. And I was actually going to leave out this last point at first until I realized that it might be actually more interesting to people here. Conformal field theories and superconformal field theories could play a role in beyond the standard model physics. And there are a number of scenarios that people have come up with, model builders have come up with, where near conformal dynamics explains patterns or solves phenomenological problems beyond the standard model. So there's walking or conformal technicolor, which relieves tensions between the electroweak scale and the flavor scale. Conformal sequestering, which deals with suppressing dangerous flavor-violating operators in Suzy theories. There's a proposed solution to the mu-b-mu problem, and even a way of generating quark and lepton, the hierarchies in quark and lepton masses. And the idea in all of these cases is to take some CFT with a particular pattern of operator dimensions and couple it to the standard model over some range of energies such that RG running coupled to this CFT generates interesting or useful patterns in the IR physics. So unfortunately, if you want to actually figure out whether these scenarios work, you often need to know things about the dimensions of operators in these theories. In N equals one superconformal theories, there is a lot that we do know, particularly with recent tools like A maximization. You can compute a lot about anything you want about chiral operators, but often the validity of some phenomenological model depends on the dimension of some non-chiral operator in a CFT where the gauge coupling is order one, and there's not very much you can say. Gravitational duals are typically useful when there's some nice effective field theory description in the bulk, and that usually requires that the CFT have some exactly marginal operator that you can dial up to very strong coupling, and that's not always the case. So in general, it's very hard to say things when the gauge coupling is order one, but of course, a major exception is in N equals four superyang mills and relatives using integrability. Now, so because of the magic in N equals four superyang mills, most of the studies of the dilatation operator in superconformal theories have been focused on theories that are closely related to it, although there's been some work recently on N equals two theories. But none of these theories are phenomenologically relevant. And the tremendous success in studying them so far suggests that maybe some interesting structures might be present in a wider class of theories. Probably not all loops integrability. We would never be that lucky. But something interesting that's not manifest in the Lagrangian. OK, so the point of view I'm going to take here is let's gather some data. Let's do the simplest computation we can in the simplest theory we can find and see what happens. So some early evidence for interesting structure in the dilatation operator of N equals 4 was a computation, a very nice computation done by Minahan and Zarembo about 10 years ago, where they computed the one-loop dilatation operator acting on operators built out of scalars in N equals 4 superyang mills and found that it was equivalent to the Hamiltonian of an exactly solvable Heisenberg spin chain. So what I'm going to do in this talk is follow their lead for a different theory, N equals 1 super QCD. So why N equals 1 super QCD? First of all, it's arguably the simplest non-trivial N equals 1 superconformal theory, certainly outside the N equals 4 family. And depending on who you're talking to, some people might say absolutely the simplest. It's been well studied. There are many things that we understand about it. Importantly for us, it admits a large N expansion and a regime of parameters in which you can do perturbation theory. And actually, because of Seiberg duality, it really admits two different regimes in which you can do perturbation theory. There's one where the electric description is weakly coupled, and another where the magnetic description is weakly coupled. And I'm going to focus on the former for this talk, but this is one of the nice things about N equals 4 is the ability to study operator dimensions in two different expansions, the strong coupling and weak coupling expansion. Here, in principle, there are, again, two different expansions that we can study. Okay, so the outline of the talk is just this. I'm going to introduce n equals 1 CZQCD and talk about how to take the large n limit in this theory. Then I'll compute the one-loop dilatation operator, we'll solve for its spectrum, and then I'll conclude. Okay, so n equals 1 CZQCD is a Suzy gauge theory. It has NF chiral matter fields in the fundamental representation and another NF in the antifundamental representation, and there are separate flavor groups acting on each. There's a U1 baryon symmetry and a single non-anomalous UNR symmetry. And the theory flows to an interacting conformal fixed point, a non-trivial interacting conformal fixed point, when NF over NC is between 3 halves and 3. Consequently, if we want to take NC to infinity, we have to take the number of flavors to infinity as well if we want to remain in the conformal window. So this is the so-called Veneziano limit, NF and NC to infinity with NF over NC fixed. And in this limit, NF over NC becomes a continuous parameter indexing a family of planar superconformal theories. So like I said, there are two weak coupling regimes. When NF over NC is close to 3, the upper end of the conformal window, then the Itauf coupling is small, and we can reliably do perturbation theory in the small parameter. And for us, we just need the first order expression here. The Itauf coupling is just equal to epsilon, where epsilon is the deviation of NF over NC away from 3. Similarly, in the magnetic, when NF over NC is close to 3 halves, you can do perturbation theory in the small parameter in that case. Okay, so we're all used to the Itauf limit, where it's useful to use double line notation. Adjoints get double lines, fundamentals and antifundamentals get single lines, and then the large N counting of a graph is determined by the genus of the Riemann surface that the graph is embedded in and the number of boundaries, where here a boundary is a fundamental or antifundamental loop. In the Veneziano limit, flavor loops count the same as gauge loops, so we need to count them as well. So fundamentals and antifundamentals should get double lines. The dotted line is a flavor line. The solid line is a gauge line. And the effect is to basically fill in the Riemann surface that the graph lives on so that the large N counting is, again, just dictated by the genus of the graph. Okay. The basic objects in the Veneziano limit are generalized single trace operators, where in addition to contracting color indices together, we can contract flavor indices. And if you're just looking at operators built out of scalars, the only things that you can make are these traces of X's and Y's, where X and Y are these flavor-contracted gauge adjoints. So a trace of a bunch of them is a flavor singlet. You could also have some string of them and stick quarks or anti-quarks on the ends, and those give you flavor adjoints and bifundamentals. And notice that in order to make these, in order to contract an SUNF left flavor group with an XUNF left flavor group, we needed both Q and Q dagger. So these operators, these generalized single trace operators, are already non-chiral. And this is forced upon us by simply demanding that we're looking at single trace operators built out of scalars. This is a little unusual if you were interested in studying the dilatation operator. We usually like to stay near operators that we know a lot about, like chiral operators. So you might ask, what about a big string of chiral operators? What's wrong with that? So for instance, we can take chiral mesons and string them together. In this case, we have to contract left flavor indices with right flavor indices, but maybe that's fine. It just doesn't transform nicely into the full flavor group, but it's a perfectly good operator. But if you construct one of these things, the point is that it's actually generalized multi-trace, despite appearances. So the way to see that is if you stick one of these operators in a correlation function. So this is a cartoon of some correlation function, a Feynman diagram for a correlation function containing one of these operators. The operator is along the top, and where the red and blue lines meet is a contraction between a left and a right flavor index. You can see just from the interactions of the theory that there's no way to fill in the middle of the graph. So the computation splits into two pieces, and consequently, dimensions and correlation functions of these things factorize. So for instance, if you wanted to take some big chain of mesons and maybe stick an impurity in it and then study what happens under the dilatation operator, there's no amplitude for the impurity to jump from one meson to another. It's just boring. So the only interesting objects that we can study if we're just building things out of scalars are these traces of x's and y's. Okay, so we've made some basic assumptions, and it means that we're focusing on a very small class of operators. And it's the computation of the dilatation operator acting on these operators is almost back of the envelope. I mean, I'd be able to show you most of the details right here. And best of all, we're not actually going to have to do any Feynman integrals. So to compute anomalous dimensions, we look at two-point functions of these operators, and we're interested in coefficients of the logarithm of the separation coming from one-loop interactions. At tree level, so we have some string of Qs and Q daggers across at some point X, another string at some point 0, and then the tree-level two-point function is just given by scalar propagators connecting these guys. And for the large n counting, they're alternating color loops and flavor loops. At one loop, we have these various one loop structures that we can just insert anywhere we want in the tree level graph. So first of all, there's wave function renormalization. And it turns out you can pick a gauge. In this case, it turns out to be Feynman gauge, where this just vanishes. So we don't have to worry about that. There are two other kinds of contributions. There's a color loop, which occurs between color-contracted pairs of quarks and anti-quarks, and a flavor loop, which occurs between flavor-contracted pairs. And this color-flavor notation is shorthand for just the graphs you see on the right. The wavy line, of course, is a gauge boson. The dotted line stands for the scalar auxiliary field in the gauge multiplet. So the dotted line really just collapses to a point. It's a non-dynamical field. So these latter two graphs on the right are just four scalar interactions. So, like I said, to actually compute all these graphs, we don't really need to do very much, just a little bit of bookkeeping. So first of all, let's look at the color loops. There are four different kinds of pairs of color-contracted quark fields. So to figure out what the contribution of color loops are, we need some 4x4 matrix. The first graph here with the gluon exchange, the gluon only cares about the color representation that the fields are in. So it can't tell, for instance, Q dagger from Q tilde. Consequently, it just contributes something proportional to the identity matrix. So there's some constant A that we don't know yet until we do the Feynman diagram on the diagonal, a factor of the Yatuf coupling, and the whole thing is flavor blind. Okay, meanwhile, the second graph is this four scalar interaction. It comes from the D-term potential of the theory. And notice that the D-term potential has a minus sign in the cross term between Q and Q tilde. So this graph contributes with some constant on the diagonal, but there's a minus sign whenever the auxiliary field is exchanged between Q and Q tilde. So we have some 4x4 matrix with this structure occurring at each color contraction. So meanwhile, the flavor loops, for the sake of flavor loops, there are two kinds of flavor contractions we can make. These are just these X and Y guys. So we have some 2x2 matrix encoding their contribution. And there are two graphs that naively contribute. The first graph actually vanishes by anti-symmetry of the gauge scalar-scalar interaction. So we only need the second graph. But the second graph we just computed, it's a four-scalar interaction. So it contributes in exactly the same way as the second graph on the previous slide with some constant B. The only difference is a few factors up front. So there's an NF over NC because this is a flavor loop instead of a color loop. And then the color structure here is really just the identity in color space, but with one exception. If you're looking at two field operators, the color indices end up getting contracted in such a way that this contribution actually vanishes. So this is really just this matrix times the identity in color space for long chains, but it's zero for two field operators. Okay, so we've characterized the dilatation operator in terms of just two parameters, and we can fix these parameters by comparing to some operators whose dimensions we know. So for instance, if we look at two field operators, like I said, there's no contribution from flavor contractions, so the 4x4 matrix that we computed a few slides ago is the whole story. And we can look at some nice protected operators that we know about. So for instance, if we take a meson, it's chiral, so the superconformal algebra dictates that its dimension is 3 halves its R charge. It's our charge we know in terms of NF and NC, and consequently in terms of the Etoft coupling. So we can just write down its anomalous dimension. Similarly, this other operator, Q dagger Q minus Q tilde dagger, is the lowest component of a supermultiplet that contains the baryon current. So it's protected. It's in a conserved current multiplet, and its anomalous dimension has to vanish. So we have two conditions, two unknowns, and we can easily solve for them. Okay, so we've solved for the dilatation operator without too much work. Now, a really useful step, a key step for us, is to write this in a nice way. Remember, the operators we're looking at are these strings of X's and Y's, and there are two kinds of them. So it's very natural to use spin chain notation with up or down for each site. Up is X, down is Y. And then, for instance, a trace of X's and Y's is a shift invariant state in the spin chain. Color contractions occur between pairs of X's and Y's, so they act as nearest neighbor interactions in this spin chain. And the flavor loops occur on a single site, within a single X or within a single Y, so that just acts on a single site on the spin chain. And we had a 4x4 matrix and a 2x2 matrix, which we can write in this form in terms of polyspin matrices. And then the whole dilatation operator is a sum over sites in the spin chain of these matrices. So that's shown down here. The first term is just a constant that depends on the length of the operator we're looking at. And the second term is more interesting and probably familiar to many of you. There's this sigma z nearest neighbor interaction, which is an Ising model interaction. And then this NF over NC times sigma x term is a magnetic field in the direction transverse to the interaction. So it's an Ising model in a transverse magnetic field, where the magnetic field is NF over NC. In this case, NF over NC is equal to 3 plus order the Etoft coupling. And we've only done a one-loop computation, so really we have to stick in 3 there. But I'm going to leave it written as NF over NC for now. Okay, so we have this nice Hamiltonian. What you do if you're me and you've never studied spin chains before is you go scouring around in some textbooks and you quickly come across the fact that this is very familiar to many people. And it's exactly soluble. Okay, so Paul actually showed us how to solve this theory on Tuesday after apologizing profusely to the experts in the audience who'd seen it before. So I'm going to do precisely the same thing. Sorry. I'm going to show you the solution again because it's simple and beautiful and interesting to think about in this context. So, all right, so the interesting part of the Hamiltonian is this transverse Ising model. And we have the spin chain with two states per site. It's very reminiscent of a fermionic Fock space. And the way to realize this, as Jordan and Vigner taught us a long time ago, is to define these non-local fermionic creation and annihilation operators, which satisfy canonical anti-commutation relations. And here, sigma x, the operator that flips the spin at a given site, is just the parity symmetry of the gauge theory, which is Q and Q tilde. Okay, so the magic thing that happens in these variables is that even though it's a non-local transformation, the Hamiltonian is still local, and it's nicer than that. It's actually quadratic in the creation annihilation operators. So you can solve it reasonably simply by going first to Fourier space and then doing a Bogolyubov transformation, redefining the fermionic creation annihilation operators. And what you're left with is the Hamiltonian for a system of free fermions with a simple dispersion relation. So when you do this, you have to be a little bit careful with the boundary conditions. Specifically, they're twisted depending on the overall parity of the operator you're looking at. So if the operator is odd parity, you need to take the momenta to have periodic boundary conditions. If the operator is even parity, the momenta should have antiperiodic boundary conditions. And remember, towards the beginning of the talk, I mentioned that there are also these flavor, adjoint, and bifundamental fields, flavor, adjoint, and bifundamental operators with open indices at the end. Because of the open indices, there's no flavor loop at the end of these operators. And the flavor loop was responsible for the flipping term, the sigma x term in the Hamiltonian. So the sites at the end are non-dynamical. There's no flipping term. It's the transverse field Ising model with fixed boundary conditions. And this is still solvable. You can go through the same procedure. You get the exact same Hamiltonian with the same dispersion relation, but an interesting quantization condition for the quasi-momenta. So this equation here is just the generalization of the evenly spaced quasi-momenta in the closed chain case. And this equation has mostly real solutions. There's one complex solution that you have to include, which corresponds to some kind of state whose wave function falls off as you go away from the edge. And these are edge localized states. Okay, so as a sanity check, let's look at a simple example of this solution. So we can look at four field operators. We can look at four field operators, in which case there are three possibilities. So if we want odd parity operators, again, we need periodic boundary conditions. And parity is also equal to fermion number in the system. So there are two odd fermion number states. Only one of them has total momentum 0 modulo 2 pi. So that's the only one that can correspond to a trace. And there's only one periodic odd operator with this number of fields. So those states have to correspond. And the anomalous dimension is simply written in terms of the dispersion relation. And meanwhile, for even parity, we need to take antiperiodic boundary conditions. In this case, both even fermion number states have 0 momentum modulo 2 pi, so they both correspond to linear combinations of the other two four-field operators. And their anomalous dimensions are given as shown. Okay, so that's it. Those are the anomalous dimensions of these operators at one loop. And here's a nice picture of them. So what we're looking at here is one end of some spectacular spectral flow of these theories between the weak coupling electric regime and the weak coupling magnetic regime. So what has to happen is these operators, you have all these operators with some free spectrum over on one side. As we start changing the Itauf coupling, so dialing up the Itauf coupling is the same as dialing down the number of flavors relative to the number of colors. As we start changing the Itauf coupling, they spread out and their levels cross in some way. And then over at the other end of the conformal window, and F over NC gets close to 3/2, what has to happen is this amazing fan of operator dimensions has to close off in some way and end up at another free spectrum. So a pretty interesting picture. It would be nice if we had more of it. Okay, so this talk was mercifully short, I believe, which I'm sure there won't be any objections to after today. It's just a simple computation with a simple and nice answer. Let me point out first a few differences between this computation and what typically arises, well, what has arisen in n equals 4. So first of all, we were stuck with non-BPS operators. The ground state, which for us isn't particularly special, it's just the state with the smallest anomalous dimension in this sector, is not BPS. It gets corrections in principle at each order in perturbation theory. And in order to figure out what it actually is, we had to do the one-loop computation, and you know we have to go and solve and find the unique state that's killed by all the annihilation operators. Another interesting feature here is that the fundamental excitations we found, these Jordan-Wigner fermions, are pretty weird from the perspective of the original degrees of freedom of the theory. So first of all, we had to organize the spin chain in terms of these X's and Y's. So these are pairs of fields, dimers, which is already somewhat different from N equals 4. Then we had to do this non-local Jordan-Wigner transformation, and finally the Bogle-Lubov transformation, by which point everything is pretty mixed up, and the fundamental excitations are these crazy fermionic solitons on the spin chain. So this is pretty weird. A natural question is, are these things still natural degrees of freedom at some higher loop level? So what happens at two loops? Is this just some sort of accident at one loop? Or do these degrees of freedom mean something? So one thing that could happen is their energy could get corrected. There could be some non-trivial S matrix induced for them. What happens? A question, of course, is what the rest of the one-loop dilatation operator of the theory looks like. Okay, so we did this computation in the electric theory. There's also the magnetic dual, which is weakly coupled. You can do perturbation theory, and you can ask what happens there. In this case, the set of operators to look at least built out of scalars, are more complicated. There are more fields in the theory, and it's not obvious what the best way to organize the spin chain was. We got a lot of mileage out of organizing our operators in terms of these X's and Y's, but in the magnetic case, it's not so clear. So that's a question to answer. And then finally, the transverse field Ising model has a lot of interesting features. In particular, it's self-dual around the H equals 1 point, magnetic field equals 1. In this computation, we got magnetic field equals 3. If there is some sense in which the transverse field Ising model is still relevant at larger values of the Itauf coupling, it's natural to ask whether this point exists in the conformal window or has any implications for N equals 1 super QCD. So that's it. I hope I've convinced you that it's interesting to look at other theories, and sometimes you might find something even if you don't quite understand why that something is what it is yet. Thank you very much.
Questions?
For small operators,
yeah.
Can you do perturbation theory in the magnetic dual? If they are small, if you don't care much about how to organize, can you at least do the first ones, the smallest ones, and then plot what their energies are?
In the magnetic dual, yeah, sure. Sure, you can do that.
Because in principle, even if you don't organize in a very smart way, for sure you would capture the bottom part of the spectrum of your picture, right?
Yeah. I mean, one interesting question is whether operators fly off to infinity or not, going from one end to the other. So there was a study done of the Kanishi operator. Kanishi operator is better understood at higher loops in this picture. At both ends of the theory, it starts out flat, and then at both ends of the window, it starts out flat and then goes like this. The paper that did this computation conjectured that the way they matched up was with some hump in the middle. But something you could equally well imagine is that they both go off to infinity and cross in some way. That question could maybe be addressed by looking at the asymptotics of the dimensions in both cases. This is definitely something that I think is worth doing.
Go ahead. Yeah, Dima in his talk had this very cool improvement of perturbation theory. So maybe if one would do it at both ends, it would... would overlap, like what he showed for strong and weak coupling. With these improvements, you really saw that they were matching. Of course, probably wrong.
The better you can do, the clearer the picture should be.
I just wanted to ask if your results have anything to do with walking technique color models. or can be learned something about?
Well, this particular result is in a planar theory, so in Technicolor type models, typically what you're interested in is the tension between the Higgs operator dimension and the Higgs mass operator dimension. Which in a planar theory, H has the same dimension as H squared. So it's hard to draw lessons from this story for walking Technicolor. I'm actually working on something that does directly address walking Technicolor, walking in conformal Technicolor right now, but that's a different story.
Maybe I missed it. Could you describe any of the properties of Banks-Zaks phase transition? Can you see in your approach this phase transition of Banks and Zak?
I'm not sure I follow.
You mentioned Banks and Zak point, yes?
Right.
In principle, this is a point where, in the theory, some phase transition can happen, yes? You have a conformal window, then at the boundary something happens. Is it seen in one loop?
I'm not. Okay, I guess the question was answered. I'm not familiar with that story, so.
Just a technical question, something I didn't quite understand. So your beta equation is actually, it should be free, right? Because, I mean, you have free fermions in the end.
Pardon?
You have free fermions.
That's
right. Basically, that's a free fermion. Free. But I didn't quite see that from your spectral equation. I mean, it looked a little funny. I mean, it should be something like e to the IPL equals 1 or minus 1 in principle, no?
Which
your spectral equation. I mean, just you have free fermions, so it's not, it's beta than beta and that's, I mean, it's just plane waves, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see this from your formula for the spectrum. I mean, the sign, I don't understand the formula, this is sign. Next page. What is this?
These are for open chains. There's no translation symmetry for open chains. It's not just a simple Fourier transform. It turns out that plane waves are the right representation, but they're not integer spaced.
So you still have to solve some kind of transcendental.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So what you can do is it's not obvious that this should work, but you write out a plane wave representation for the new creation annihilation operators, and you require that the adjoint action of the Hamiltonian on these things be diagonalized, and it turns out you can solve this condition, assuming this holds. So it's not a Fourier transform because there's no translation invariance, but it still works. It's not obvious, which is perhaps why the earliest reference we could find for it was 2004. I'm assured that this solution probably existed in somebody's notes, if not published before then. But
There's another example similar to one you considered, which is n equal 2, Supergamil theory, equal 2.
Right.
Then you have two scalar. Complex scalar. And then you could consider a similar operator when you have something like, let's call it phi. Then you could have a local operator, which is built out of the phi and phi dagger.
Right.
Single trace operator. And then if you look for one loop dilatation operator for such operators, you will find that it mapped into XXX spin chain, but it's not XXX, but XXZ.
Huh. Is this related to, this is n equals 2?
N equal 2 Supergamil theory.
Uh-huh.
And you're talking about operators similar to one you're considering, just built out only of the scalars. You have only two real scalars, or one complex, or one conjugated. You have two real scalars in this theory.
Right.
Out of which you make a complex scalar, and a complex conjugated one, five dagger.
I'm still not understanding the question.
No, it's not a question. It's a comment. Just simply to tell you that there is another example. About not n equal 4, so the Yang-Mills theory, when you have integrability at one level and the corresponding Hamiltonian. In your case, it's sort of...
n equals 2. I see.
Yeah.
So no more questions? Then let's thank David again. And since this was the last talk of the conference, let me thank on behalf of all